Hello, I'm Marty Kirilovich with my co-host Holly Carson, and welcome to another episode of Science in the Fiction. In our last episode, we talked to Justin Gregg about his book, If Nietzsche Were a Narwhal, What Animal Intelligence Reveals About Human Stupidity, which was a fantastic book about the wonderful things that happen inside the skull of the human animal, and how these things are unique in the animal world in both good ways and bad. Well, we flipped the script a little bit here, and instead of talking to a scientist about a science fiction book, we've asked the science fiction author to talk about a science book. So in this episode, Holly and I had the great privilege to talk to our very own Peter Watts about Justin Gregg's book. So let's get the basics out of the way first. Peter has a PhD in marine biology and put some serious science into his writing, with special insight into evolution, intelligence, and consciousness. He's written about a dozen books and is best known for the Hugo-nominated Blind Sight, about which we'll be talking more in our next episode. He won the Hugo for his novelette The Island in 2010, which forms part of a series of stories in the Sunflower universe, which includes his most recent book, The Freeze Frame Revolution. Not only is Peter Watts a renowned science fiction author whose name is known in all the best circles, he is an author who I dare say is perhaps less famous than he is infamous. I like to call him the bad boy of Canadian science fiction. And by the end of this episode, you'll probably know why. He's edgy and bold and can be quite ruthless. And it's not just that he can come off as a bit of a pessimist with a confrontational style, sometimes overly critical, and one might even say brutal in his analysis of both the human and planetary condition. It's also that the word misanthrope has been used to describe him, but in the nicest possible way, and with a good dose of his dark sense of humor. Peter Watts deserves a bit more of an introduction than usual, because you have to get in the right mood to properly hear what he's saying. He's the kind of guy who begins an interview by alerting any current or future law enforcement agencies that he doesn't care if they're trying to incriminate him or me for some bullshit reason. He's also the kind of guy that makes you wonder, if you invite him on your show, should you include any disclaimers to disavow yourself from any association with his more extreme ideas for saving the world through creative genetic bioterrorism or by spiking the water supply with neuromodulators? Actually, the real reason I need to take a little extra time to tell you about Peter Watts is because there's a story about Peter that I need to tell you, which is relevant to the second half of the following interview, where Peter refers to our time together at Fan Expo in Toronto a few years ago. Back when I was working on another podcast called Tales from the Bridge, we got a plenary session and invited Peter Watts to give a talk. He asked if there's anything he couldn't say, and we said, of course not. Who are we to censor the message of a highly educated and acclaimed science fiction author? So, Peter began his lecture with a little clip from a TV show that showed a mother and son starting their vacation at a bus station, talking to a stranger about caring for the environment and saving carbon emissions by taking a bus instead of flying. So the stranger responds by saying to the mother, well, if you care about the environment so much, why don't you slit your son's throat? Because that's the best way for you to lower your environmental impact. Well, that's when all the parents with small children got up and left the auditorium. And Peter went on to give a rousing lecture on how we're all doomed. It's too late to save the planet. We have to face facts, people, and the facts are very, very bad. So the only hope we might have is for a radical bioterrorist to take matters in their own hands and hack the human genome to rewire our brains so we don't continue to be such greedy assholes. So that's one of my favorite stories about Peter Watts. I tell it a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but also to let you know that while Peter may seem a little harsh, bleak, and critical, this stems from his being unremittingly realistic and stubbornly facing the data about our catastrophic situation, even as that data continues to get worse. But in person, as you'll see right away, he's a super nice guy, generous, gregarious, and kind. He's just not the kind of guy who is going to pull his punches. I also tell you this to prepare you, and Justin Gregg, for Peter's analysis of If Nietzsche Were a Narwhal. It may seem a bit harsh, but you have to take it with a grain of salt and appreciate the inimitable honesty and bluntness of Peter's style. Partly because he has amazing biological insight about intelligence, consciousness, and evolution, and partly because we're going to put Justin and Peter into a room together to discuss each other's work. And I hope everyone is going to get along and still like each other after hearing this interview. So with that, we give you the irrepressible, irreverent, brutally honest, and darkly hilarious bad boy of Canadian science fiction, Peter Watts.
I have to admit, I'm a little disappointed that I tried to sort of boot up this link in Brave and it wouldn't load. And then I tried to boot it up in Firefox and said, incompatible browser, you need the latest version of Firefox. And since I have the latest version of Firefox, I can only assume that it objected to the fact that I had various privacy plugins and ad blockers installed. So I've had to pull up, for probably the first time since I've installed this OS, I've had to pull up Chromium, which is Google, which is, you know, a system whose entire business model is based on the scraping, surveillance, and intrusion into, you know, its users' personal lives. So thanks for that.
Sorry, Peter. I know that is not your bag. That is a...
But here I am, as long as we don't say anything that, you know, law enforcement might want to, you know, get their hands on. I suppose we probably have nothing to hide.
Probably.
I don't know. Yeah. But I suppose you just spoke the keyword. So now we're being listened to.
Yeah. Yeah. Allah Akbar. Pipe bomb.
Uh-oh.
The AIs have got us now.
Here we go. Not again.
Well, thanks for joining us. Nice to see you again. Yeah, so you read Justin Gregg's book over the last week, I guess. Why don't we start there? What did you think of it in general? How did it?
Well, it was a book I wanted to argue with a lot.
Right.
And I say that in a really good way, because one of the things I miss about grad school is just sitting across the table from somebody with a pitcher and just nitpicking the shit out of things and arguing with people's points of view. And I get the sense that I would really love to sit down and have a beer with Justin Gregg.
Right.
I agree with a lot of his baseline suppositions. I agree that we humans tend to exalt ourselves out of all proportion to the good that we do. I agree that the planet would be way better off without us than with us. I agree that to some extent, our intelligence is kind of a bad thing. I'm interested in whether he has read Galapagos by Kurt Vonnegut. I don't know if you guys have.
I haven't, no.
It came out in the 80s and it basically had the same premise, which was that the villain in the book was our big brains. And the premise of the book was a bunch of B-list celebrities happened to be on a tour of the Galapagos when a massive pandemic struck and wiped out the rest of the human race. So you got all these B-list celebrities on a volcanic island with no smelting, no metals, nothing that they can do. And gradually, so natural selection takes over. And most of the story takes place a million years in the future when intelligence has proven to be completely useless because it hogs oxygen. And the only way humanity can survive is by eating fish, which means that we basically are turning back into sort of weird seal-like things, which means we need a small brain so that we can hold our breath longer. And the one thing that has persisted of human civilization is that when all the humans are sort of hauled out on the beach sunning themselves a million years down the road, when one of them farts, all the others will laugh and laugh and laugh. And that is the one surpassing accomplishment of human civilization that survives into the future. And I always thought that book was sadly maligned. I thought it was great. It showed a kind of a profound sense that evolution is not progressive. Mm. Evolution shapes what works.
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily mean you get smarter or more complex. It means that you adapt to whatever environment you happen to be in. So that said, And all due respect to this dude, who's, you know, obviously a very smart guy, I profoundly disagree with his ultimate conclusion, weirdly enough.
What was his ultimate conclusion?
His ultimate conclusion essentially is that I mean, it's spelled out pretty much right in the title, you know, what animal intelligence reveals about human stupidity, that our kind of intelligence, the ability to ask why and to figure things out, is actually maladaptive. And that other creatures are essentially smarter in an evolutionary and in a fitness sense. And oddly enough, I mean, I can agree with certain elements of that, but I think he's got it completely ass backwards in a weird way. And I think the reason for that is he's made some curiously inconsistent and I think downright fallacious comparison and arguments throughout the course of the book. He says things that he contradicts later on. He will say, for example, that, you know, one thing you need for death wisdom is this ability to experience mental time travel, to be able to look ahead. And he says, animals can't do that. Later on in the book, he says animals can do that. All animals can do that because blah, blah, blah. But this is not the first time he contradicts himself. And I mean, anybody who's had a cat, I mean, I knew a cat once who hated another cat. And he would see this cat going past the window, and then he would run over and wait by the cat flap, waiting for his rival cat to try and come in, and they wail on him, right? Right. Now, it's hard to explain that in any other way than the ability to sort of cast forward in time.
Right.
You see something here, you anticipate that it's going to be there in the future.
Yeah.
There is a trajectory involved, and you make plans. And things do this all the time. And he will admit that you know, sometimes they do this, sometimes animals do this, but, you know, not many, and they can't really, you know, it can't really be a widespread phenomenon. He says the same things about, you know, at one point he says, chimpanzees, you know, can't possibly have the kind of intellectual wisdom that we, and he says this in deference to chimpanzees. He thinks that their intelligence is of a better kind than ours. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they certainly can't imagine this with a brain that's merely a third the size of ours.
Right.
But then he, like a couple of chapters later, he talks about how brain size has absolutely nothing to do with intelligence. It's completely decoupled. He says, he points out that, you know, there are some people out there who have like virtually no brain. They've got 10-15% of normal brain temperature, and they've got normal IQs. So obviously you can't. You know, you can't, which would seem to contradict what he was saying in the first place. But I'm familiar with some of these studies because they scared the shit out of me. Like, you find out, I mean, there was a paper that came out in Science in 1980, literally called, "Is Your Brain Really Necessary?" And I'm pretty sure this is what Justin Gregg was referring to. It's this guy who was, you know, he had a slightly larger head than normal. And he had an IQ of 126. Degree in engineering, who had headaches. He went to the doctor. The doctors did a, you know, an MRA, and, you know, well, you know, the good news is it's not brain cancer. The bad news is it can't be brain cancer because you have virtually no detectable brain.
Right.
And what had happened was that the ventricles holding cerebral spinal fluid that normally are just these little walnut sized things down in the center of the brain had expanded to the point that most of his head was just full of fluid.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
And that there was somewhere between, I mean, I've got the x-ray, or I've got the CAT scan somewhere in my PDF, somewhere in my hard disk. It's quite creepy. It's just this vast, empty skull. And the estimate was, somewhere between, 10 to 15% of the normal brain. And these results, you know, sometimes tended to be a bit controversial, stirred up a bunch of stuff. The usual religious nut jobs jumped in and said, see, the soul is not something that is connected to the brain because you don't actually need a brain. And there are, you know, you obviously couldn't cut this guy's head open because of so-called ethical concerns. So there was, you had to wonder, you know, okay, did he actually only have 10 to 15% of a brain? Or was it the fact that hydrostatic pressure from the increasing size of the ventricles simply pushed a normal brain and compressed it so that you actually had the same number of neurons, the same number of synapses in a smaller volume?
Right.
There's been some work done on small networking and so on that suggests that in some cases, this kind of brain damage could actually enhance computational efficiency.
Neat. And they didn't like have a look at his brain after he died? Or is he still alive?
Sorry?
They didn't look at his brain after he died or something?
I don't know if he's still alive. Of course, it's one of those things where you name the guy by an initial, right? Because for privacy reasons. I don't know what happened to this guy. And it's also important to recognize that there are other people out there, some of whom, you know, with similar situations, the most of the head is either filled with fibrous tissue or with cerebrospinal fluid. And in a lot of cases, yeah, some of these people are perfectly normal. A lot of them are rutabagas. So it's not a, you know, you cannot draw the conclusion that that brain size is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. But he does, even though this contradicts, you know, earlier he says the chimpanzee couldn't possibly have this level of cognition because their brain is so small. If something with 10 to 15% of a human brain can have an IQ of 126, why couldn't a chimp?
Right.
A Homo habilis now, we think, had a brain sort of between chimps and humans. And as far as we know now, they seem to have had a sophisticated language. This is inferences that have just been made over the past few years. Nobody thought that something with that small a brain could have language. Mm-hmm. But they seem to. We're discovering corvids and parrots, for example, right? They're dumb little brains. Why are they so smart? Turns out their neuronal density is 3 times that of comparable mammals.
Right.
So in terms of computational power, a corvid's brain is 3 times bigger than it should be, than it appears to be.
Right.
So he makes these various, he contradicts himself in these ways. So on the one hand, when it suits him, he will say, you know, they can't possibly do this because their brains are too small. And then on the other hand, he says brain size doesn't make a difference.
Right.
He makes, in some cases, claims about the limitations of non-human intelligence. And then he will go on and he will come up with actual case studies of things that contradict that. He'll say, well, you know, these guys can do it, and these guys can do it, and these guys have foresight, and these guys are capable of a certain kind of math. But it's probably really limited. Most of them probably can't do that. And I find that curious because, I mean, there's this famous saying, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And given how hard it is, how intractable problems of conscious perception are, I mean, I can't even prove empirically that you guys are sentient.
Right.
Right? I can infer things from behavioral cues, but there's no way to actually get inside your head and see what your perspective is.
Yeah.
And so given that the issue itself is so intractable, I'm kind of surprised we've got any examples at all that animals are capable of these kind of cognitive feats. And in fact, we do. So what we actually have is some evidence of presence is not evidence of absence.
Right.
And yet his conclusion is, after citing, you know, anywhere from 3 or 4 different cases of animals that can do this, is to say, yeah, but you know, that's probably not very widespread.
Yeah.
And he doesn't cite any data to suggest why it wouldn't be widespread, as opposed to why it's just we haven't discovered it yet because it's a really, really tough knot to untie.
Yeah.
I think fundamentally his big problem is to compare cognition with evolution. Time and time again, he will compare us to anything from bed bugs to crocodiles and say, yeah, look at the, you know, a crocodile is, you know, capable of this incredibly superb kind of thing. Our human, you know, we will bungee jump off a high cliff and not make, you know, we'll make a mathematical mistake and we'll smash our heads open. Chimpanzee would never do that. And he talks about how the simple bed bug mind is smarter than the human mind in terms of figuring out how to get around various pesticides and so on. And the dude is smart, but what he's doing, he's basically comparing apples to moon rocks.
Right.
It's the fact that a bed bug has a sophisticated and elegant solution. That's not the bed bug thinking. That's a few tens of thousands of generations of bed bug evolution that shaped a particular behavioral pattern.
Right.
And so he's taking something that is a population level natural selection process that takes thousands and tens of thousands of generations to come up with. And he's comparing it to a single organism in real time working out a problem.
Yeah.
And equating those two is just, it's a bullshit comparison. He talks about the elegance of the crocodilians, you know, and yeah, crocodilians are cool. I mean, right, you know, Sheikh Salib came and punched the earth in the face. Everything died off. Most everything died off. The crocodilians barely even changed, right?
Right.
And so he cites this as an example of, you know, better intelligence. The lower level intelligence is better. And he doesn't acknowledge the fact that, yeah, crocodilians survived the KT extinction, and we almost wiped them out, turning them into handbags and shoes. And the only reason those fuckers are alive today is because we pulled back and allowed them to live.
Right.
So it's not that they were. It's not that the crocodiles had evolved this great. Oh, we're gonna have to do something to make them not want to turn us into handbags. They were at our mercy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, again, what he's talking about is not the superior intelligence of the crocodiles. What he's talking about is, you know, Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park basically saying life will find a way. Mm. Like, he's talking about a biosphere with a few million species, right? Basically a bunch of darts thrown at a board, at a wall. Some of them, by definition, are going to like hit the board, right? So evolution whips a few million darts at the board. An asteroid comes along, wipes out everything. And then Justin Gregg comes in afterwards and looks at the one dart that's left and draws a bullseye around it and says, wow, don't the crocodiles have great aim?
Right.
But it wasn't the crocodiles. It was all of life. Life is resilient. Life will adapt. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in that particular moment, it was the crocodiles that happened to be the variant of life that survived that particular stressor. But when it came to like not turning into handbags, they were helpless.
Right.
And so I think these kind of fallacies kind of inform why I disagree with his fundamental. And it's weird because I agree and disagree. I totally agree with the fact that our intelligence is fucked, that we have. But his argument is that the animal wisdom is superior to human wisdom.
Right.
The reason I think that we're fucked is not because we're intelligent. It's because our intelligence is still shackled to these animal instincts. I mean, he what did he call it? Prognostic myopia? Yeah. Which is, as far as I can see, he's just rebranding hyperbolic discounting, which is a well-known phenomenon, which is, you know, I give you a choice, you know, the marshmallow test. You've heard of the marshmallow test.
Yes.
A more adult example is, you know, you can have 10 bucks today or 20 bucks in 2 weeks. And most people take the 10 bucks today. And that actually makes a fair bit of sense in hostile, unpredictable environments because, you know, 2 weeks is a long time. The guy who has the 10 bucks could get hit by a bus or eaten by a tiger or something, right? So it's, you know, a bird in the hand worth two in the bush. Fair enough. But the flip side of that is it makes it almost impossible to internalize long-term consequences. And he does that. He has a whole chapter on that. And he's dead right. But that's not a human problem. That's a cognitive bias that, you know, if crocodiles got intelligent, they would suffer the same thing. There are like a couple of hundred of cognitive biases that help you survive by lying to you. And the problem is not that animal wisdom is somehow better than human intelligence. The problem is that human intelligence is still enslaved to animal wisdom. We have the ability to create godlike technology. We have brains like the chimpanzees, like the crocodiles, like the humble bedbugs. We have brains that evolved to deal with immediate problems, local problems, short-term consequences. Whatever happened right now was what natural selection, you know, helped us survive. And now we have this bigger brain that allows us to create problems with global long-term consequences. And we are not capable of internalizing that. We can imagine it cognitively. We don't feel it down in the gut. I think the example he used was, you know, he wanted to get a banana and he didn't think about the carbon imprint of what it took to like ship a banana from Panama and so on, the carbon imprint. I think a more appropriate example would be climate change versus being charged by a grizzly bear. If you see a grizzly bear running at you, you know what to do. I mean, you're going to fucking run because your brain is keyed to responding to predator threats. I hold up a contingency table or an ANOVA chart or a multilinear regression saying what's going to happen as a result of climate change in 50 years, we're simply not wired to internalize that on the same gut level.
Right.
So I would argue that like the crocodiles and the chimps and the bedbugs, their wisdom can be optimal as long as the environment doesn't change. But the environment always changes. And at some point, another asteroid's going to hit. And the wisdom of the bedbugs and the wisdom of the crocodilians is not going to get them off the planet when the sun goes nova. If you want to really take a long view, we need some kind of sophisticated cognition for long-term survival. The problem is that sophisticated cognition is still tied to a caveman brain that's fundamentally no different from that of a bedbug, a crocodilian, or a chimp. And so I would argue that the thing we have to do is not suppress human intellect, but unshackle human intellect from all these animal instincts that are keeping us acting like crocodiles and chimps, when in fact we should somehow, there's so many ways that we could, and you know this, Marty, because I alienated an entire room full of Comic-Con people.
I heard about that.
By talking about the various ways in which we could rewire the human brain so that it is not susceptible to all these cognitive biases.
Right.
And of course, you know, you say that and people think you're batshit. You know, it's like this is comic book villain stuff, right? It's somebody with like the bankroll of Elon Musk and the scruples of the Joker and the genetic smarts of Craig Venter, all in sort of one big mustache twirling package, and it's batshit. And of course it's batshit because none of the sane solutions have worked. Mm-hmm. I mean, the last COP was run in a petro state, run by a guy who's the head of an oil company, who used that to promote further oil development. And this is in the wake of the hottest year on record in 125,000 years. Cities are literally burning to the ground now. Cities are literally underwater. A third of Pakistan was underwater. And this is how we respond. I think a batshit supervillain might be the only hope that we have.
Right. Hey, I need to back you up for our listeners. And since you've mentioned it, I think you got to tell our listeners more details about your batshit supervillain solution to planetary and human survival by breaking people's brains appropriately.
Well, there's a number of ways. Like one of the things one of the ways that we have justified the destruction, not only of each other, but of the planet, is through religious belief. And religious belief is, you know, rationally it's batshit insane, but it's also adaptive. A comparative study of kibbutzes in Israel, ironically enough these days, showed that religious communities, all other variables being equal, a religious community would have a longer lifespan than a non-religious community. And within those religious communities, the one that lasted the longest were like the Handmaid's Tale communities, the ones with the really, really strict patriarchal, authoritarian structures where you basically go to hell if God sees you masturbating.
No, thank you.
And there's all sorts of reasons why that should be, you know, high entry and high exit costs. If you believe in the sort of woolly God that welcomes everybody, you come away, you go away. But if the only way you can join the cult is to give all your daughters for the sexual gratification of you know, the guru who's running everything, you're going to be really hardcore. And if the exit cost is getting stoned or shunned or litigated into oblivion, as happened with, you know, ex-Scientologists, you're going to be more likely to stay. So there's all sorts of reasons for that to be the case. But what it all comes down to is and there's also the sense of surveillance. If you believe in a supernatural ghost that's watching what you do, it keeps you in line. Once civilizations get to the point where you can't keep an eye on each other. So the bigger a community grows, the greater you need some kind of a threat to keep people behaving. And as a result, you know, gays are evil and we're going to kill trans people The guys down at the other end of the Red Valley are the bad guys, and we're going to go to war with them, and it's God that's on our side. And just fucking look at the Middle East. I mean, it's not like I have to cite specific examples of what's going on here. It turns out that Parkinson's disease suppresses the religious impulse.
I heard that too.
We don't know why. It might have something to do with the dopaminergic networks. It's exactly the opposite of what you would expect. You would think that somebody with a terminal disease would find God. The whole no atheists in foxholes and palliative care wards, you know.
But apparently epilepsy makes it stronger, the religious it suppresses the religious impulse.
That's interesting, because there are, you know, one of the hypotheses concerning Paul, who brought Christianity to the Gentiles, was that he had an epileptic seizure on the road to Damascus.
Right.
Damascus. So one of the things I think of is, let's figure out what it is about Parkinson's disease that suppresses the religious impulse. If we could make that contagious, you could turn most people. I mean, the ecological impact of eating red meat is pretty horrendous. The IPCC and the UN and so on have been subject to strong lobbying by the meat market, so it doesn't tend to get mentioned. But methane production, rainforests being felled to make cattle production, the amount of energy that goes into actually creating meat. There is a kind of tick called the Lone Star tick, which when it bites you, you're okay for, you know, about a month. But after that, if you bite into a hamburger, you die of anaphylactic shock. Because this thing induces a lethal aversion to a kind of monosaccharide called alpha-galactose-galactose, something rather. It's a long chain molecule, which is found in red meat. So if you could take whatever it is that the tick does, and if you can like use CRISPR to port it to horse flies and mosquitoes and deer flies and every other kind of biting insect, at some point you'll have a large chunk of the human race that is no longer able to eat red meat without dying. Now, the exception to this is the one kind of red meat that doesn't have this monosaccharide are primates.
Ooh.
So we could eat each other. If we really wanted red meat, we could eat humans. We could eat chimps too, but you know, they're on the way out anyhow. The one thing that there's too many of is people. So if we really wanted to have red meat once this thing took its toll, we'd have to eat each other. And I don't have a problem with that. That's another possibility is to ramp up nociceptin production in the brain. Nociceptin is kind of the anti-dopamine. Dopamine is this reward-seeking chemical that makes you spikes when you anticipate a reward. It doesn't really make you feel good, but it makes you anticipate a reward. So, I mean, if you look at people, you know, playing the one-armed bandits in casinos, they're hooked on dopamine, even though they don't seem very happy. They're just grimly waiting for the next payoff. Nociceptin is kind of a depressive chemical. Nociceptin is basically kind of an indifference chemical. It makes you, the thing about, you've heard of Robert Sapolsky? Mm-mm. He's a huge, he's a neuroscientist and primate biologist out of Stanford. He did Behave. The Trouble with Testosterone. His most recent book is called, I think, Determined. It's basically an argument against free will. And he laments that the biggest problem about human nature, the thing that he would most like to change, is our ability to acclimate to good fortune. You spend most of your life having, you know, a bowl of rice a day, and somebody gives you three bowls of rice a day. At first, you feel incredibly fortunate. You feel so lucky. And then after a while, you get entitled to it. You get used to it. And then after a little while longer, you want more. It's not enough. And this goes from the number of bowls of rice you get up to the number of super yachts you can afford.
Right.
So you could actually make an argument that, you know, if Elon Musk lost half of his, you know, multi-billion dollar empire, he would literally be suffering on a biochemical level more than somebody who had to cut back their rice consumption, because your baseline neurochemistry for satisfaction constantly gets reset. And as a result, you always want more. Nociceptin is kind of the fuck you guys, I'm going home hormone. It's like, I don't really want to fight for this anymore. I don't care if the other guy has more super yachts than me. If we could somehow, pump that into the water supply, that would make us less greedy assholes. There is evidence that certain types of lesions, brain damage in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, makes us more utilitarian. It makes you more likely to sacrifice your own child in a burning building if that means that you can save two strangers. It's not something most people would do. You've got the whole kin selection thing, right? Kin selection is kind of the heart of all problems. Kin selection is sort of the heart of the onion that ends up with tribalism, that ends up with xenophobia. And there are people with certain types of lesions in their brain who are basically immune to trolley paradoxes. This is assuming that saving the greatest number of human lives is a good thing, which is certainly up for debate. but assuming that saving more lives versus saving your kid's life, if somebody, the thought experiment I like to play is supposing a mother basically decides to save three strangers and lets her own two children die. Are the headlines the next day going to read, you know, noble mother sacrifices her own genes to save strangers? Or is it going to be monster mother lets their own daughter die in a burning house? Like, it's basically the difference between morals and ethics. If you do the ethical thing, you're considered immoral. And I have absolutely no idea, you know, how we would weaponize or make something, how we would design a bug in, I don't know, an encephalitis jacket or something to go in and rewire the ventromedial prefrontal cortex in 8 billion people. I have absolutely no clue. And nobody does, because try get funding for that. but those are just a few ways what it basically comes down to is that the way I think to save humanity is to turn it into something else. Because so much of what we are these cognitive biases that warp reality. I'm writing a couple of stories essentially based on the dichotomy of the choice that you can either see things as they really are, or you can care whether you live or die. You can't optimize along both axes at the same time, because your desire to survive is informed by all these cognitive biases, which by definition bias you. You cannot see the world as it truly is if you are enthralled to these hundreds of biases that in some cases are still adaptive, but at least used to be adaptive, even now they threaten the planet. So that's just, you know, those are a few of the ideas. I've been kicking around. I don't think we're going to do it. Which is why I kind of agree, you know, that I mean, I don't agree. Justin cited the Global Catastrophic Risk Report that suggested that there was an almost 10% chance that humanity would go extinct before the end of the century. I don't think that's going to happen biologically. All the evidence I've seen suggests that society, global technological society, civilization is going to collapse around 2050. All the best estimates seem to be converging on that. But we're a pest species. And so we will continue to, you know, by the end of the 21st century, we'll basically be living in the 18th century. We will still exist here and there in little pockets. We just won't have Xboxes or laptops to play with. We'll essentially be feudal agrarians sort of beating each other over the heads over the last tin of Spam that we dig out of the rubble, which is still pretty grim. But you know, there have been 5 major extinctions on this planet so far. And I've seen it argued that we shouldn't call this an extinction event. The Anthropocene should not be regarded as an extinction event, but an extermination event, because it's the first time that one species is set out to essentially consciously wipe out entire ecosystems. But whatever, at some point, we will do ourselves in. And it may take 10 or 20 million years, but something else will grow back. And that gives me hope. There will be, whatever happens, there will be a glorious and diverse and wonderful biosphere a few million years down the road once we're gone.
But as you say, without a species capable of saving the entire planet from a comet strike or the sun blowing up or any of the rest of it, right? It's great as long as everything's in balance and nothing changes. But you know, when there is a crisis, all that's gone too, right? Right now, I guess we're the crisis for the rest of the ecosystem, but also we're kind of the brain capable of creating solutions to extreme problems that we're creating currently, and hopefully we can solve extreme problems we're creating, but other problems we're created too.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, I think that's fundamentally where I disagree with Justin. I think we have the potential to kick all kinds of ass in the best possible way.
Right.
I think we have, and there are enough cases of people who've actually done this, people who have used their brains to control their instincts. But most of us as a species, statistically, we just use our big brains to make excuses for our instincts, to basically come up with political or religious rationales to justify acting pretty much the same way that sticklebacks and spiders and deer behave. Mm. It's just that, you know, we're obeying God's laws instead of mate guarding. Mm. We're spreading democracy instead of fighting over resources. We have the capability to be so much better than that. But, and we, I think even now, we have the capability to roll back climate change. I just don't see any evidence that we will.
Right. Yeah.
There aren't enough of us. I mean, if we were all Greta Thunberg, that would be great. If we were all on that part of the spectrum that allows her to internalize mid to long-term threats the same way we internalize a grizzly bear attacking us, that's what we need. And she's got it.
Right.
But she's just one kid, and chances are somebody's going to assassinate her within the next 5 or 10 years anyway.
That's so sad.
Yeah, you raise this issue, especially, you know, with this these ideas for modifying humans to be less dangerous to ourselves and the environment. You know, people are horrified by that because it involves so many risks, right? Oh, gosh, you know, boy, who knows what could happen if we did that? And we don't seem to have the ability, like you're saying, to internalize the risks that we are currently taking by engaging in the status quo. Right. And there is this calculus that needs to happen where we got to realize like what we're doing now is possibly more dangerous than most of the most extreme things we could think up to try to counteract it. But we don't do that. And we're still on this bus and we're driving it to the cliff and nobody has the gumption to like turn the wheel. And as you say, maybe what we need is, you know, just a crazy villain to take over and make a unilateral sort of, you know, decision and run it to the front and turn that wheel. Now, the bus might roll. We might die anyway, but we're going to die this
week. Just this week, they released new data suggesting that the Greenland ice sheet is losing 3 million tons an hour
right.
of ice. It's more than any, again, as this is an ongoing litany. The thing, we have our best case scenarios, we have our worst case scenarios, and then 10 years later on, we have the reality that these scenarios predicted. And the reality is almost always worse than the worst case scenario. And so now they're saying that there's an increased chance that the meridional current could shut down. And that means, you know, ironically, because of climate change, England and Europe turn into Siberia because you no longer have the Gulf Stream carrying warm water up. That's something that people have been thinking about for quite some time. And it's just gotten a little more, likely now. A few years ago, people were saying, oh my God, you know, at this rate, the Amazonian rainforest is going to stop being a carbon sink and it's going to start being a carbon producer at this rate of deforestation. And it'll happen in like 10 to 30 years. And then like 3 years later, it's like, oops, it's already happened. Mm. There are already big chunks of the Amazon that are actually contributing now to carbon production.
Wow.
So yeah, we're already... we're already off the cliff. And I would argue that what I'm doing, the things that I'm suggesting, yeah, they're batshit. It's like there's a branch on the other side of the chasm that's 100 feet away. And I'm saying, let's jump for that thing. And we probably won't do it. But the only other alternative is you turn in a road pizza at the bottom of the cliff. You know, when the plane is already, you know, down at 10,000 feet in a nosedive, you might as well just start punching buttons at random to see what happens.
Hey, Peter, have you read Kim Stanley Robinson's latest, The Ministry for the Future?
I am ashamed to say, I think I've read two of Kim Stanley Robinson's short stories. I haven't read any of his novels. I've got Antarctica. I've got one of the Mars books. It's a big gap in my... You know, obviously, there's no excuse for it. I mean, right now, I've just started Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. So, like that tells you how far behind the curve I am on these things, right? And it doesn't help when somebody says, oh, we want you to do this podcast. Here's a book we want you to read. So, yeah, I had to drop Octavia Butler. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, you're going to love that one. It is brutal and horrific and terribly sad.
Yeah. I'm like one chapter in and it's, you know, it's easy to understand and that's nice. It's a quick read.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we talked to Kim Stanley Robinson a few weeks ago and, you know, the Ministry for the Future is basically his prescription. He's a guy who understands climate change, understands, you know, a bunch of possible solutions. And it's basically like his recipe book for throwing everything he can think of at the problem, not just scientifically, but economically and psychologically and sociologically and, to see if we can actually, pull out. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff that would need to be done that would cost trillions of dollars that we're just not going to do. But if we did, it might work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's sort of always been held up as, you know, oh, all you doom scrollers writing dystopias. That's why, you know, NASA is falling apart. That's why that's why the space program fell apart, because you guys stopped dreaming big. And Kim Stanley Robinson, why can't you be like Kim Stanley Robinson? He's so optimistic. But I read a couple of years ago, I read an interview with the guy where he says, you know, when the best case scenario you can come up with, when the most optimistic scenario you can come up with is you've managed to avoid the extinction of the species, barely. Like, what does that say? It sounded like even he was kind of giving up and throwing in the towel on his attempts to be optimistic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, this feels like this should have been the second half of our interview.
you can always swap it around in post.
Well, I might. I've done that once for another interview. I wanted to back up and maybe talk more about you and talk about your work and talk about maybe Blind Sight. Because I thought, you know, related to Justin's book, you know, he talks about intelligence, he talks about consciousness, and I think that's a really interesting, good theme to contemplate with science fiction authors, especially like you, because in Blindsight, you sort of put together a pretty unique view of the relationship between those two things. And now in your email to me, you also said, you know, he's commented that you listened to Paco Calvo's interview and said that he's confusing consciousness with computation. And so I thought maybe, could you just talk about the relationship there between intelligence, computation, and maybe computation and intelligence are the same thing. Like intelligence is just problem solving ability in my mind, and computation can do that. Computation can run good algorithms to solve problems. So why have consciousness? What do we need that for?
And that's the cliffhanger where we're going to leave you for now. We'll pick up right here in our next episode in part two of our conversation with Peter Watts. We'll talk more about his own thoughts on intelligence and consciousness as portrayed in his novel Blindsight, and as his thinking has changed and evolved on that topic over the last decade or so. Tune in next time on The Science in the Fiction, and thanks for listening.